Good morning. Let us join together in prayer. Gracious God, may we hear what you have to say to us today. Give us the ears and the heart to be open and receiving. Amen. This past Wednesday evening, it was about 5 o'clock, and my husband had left for work. He teaches at OSU, so he had an evening class, so he wouldn't be home for a few more hours. And I had just put dinner in the oven, and I laid out a blanket on our living room floor so that I could do tummy time with my daughter, who's almost 6 months old. And she's at 6 months, according to all the websites, babies are supposed to be able to roll over both ways, and my daughter is not there yet. So I was like, all right, we're gonna focus on that tonight, and we're gonna practice rolling over, and she can get about halfway there, and then she's stuck. So we gotta kinda nudge her, and she'll keep rolling over. So my 4-year-old, my 6-year-old, and I are all on the floor, and we're encouraging her, come on, Daisy, you can do it, and you know, she'd get halfway there, and we'd roll her over, and I hear the tea kettle whistle behind me in the kitchen because I had put some tea on, and I go into the kitchen, and I have just poured a cup of tea when I hear Daisy screaming from the living room, and I run over, and she is stuck on her side, but her arm is behind her against the floor, bent in an awkward way, and I ran to her, and I picked her up. And she's still screaming, and I try to comfort her, and it becomes very, very obvious to me very quickly that that things are not okay, that something is wrong, and I notice that her arm is limp, and she's not moving it, and I immediately call our next-door neighbor, who's a retired firefighter, and I said, you need to come over here right now, and she runs over, and she looks at the baby, and she says, you need to get her to the ER, but I have to hold her. I can't put her in her car seat. So I can't drive and hold her. And I said, well, you drive me. And she says, I can't. My 4-year-old has the stomach flu, and I'm home alone with him. And he's still in the house by himself. And so she couldn't drive me. So I start calling people that I know within closest distance to me. Within 10 minutes, I'm being driven to the ER with Daisy by a neighbor that I don't know. I have another neighbor, when she got the call, she was actually in Costco. She abandons her shopping cart in Costco and drives across town to make sure that my kids are cared for. Two other friends who are not home as well start coming over to our house. And when we get to the ER, I expect this neighbor to just sort of drop me off and I go in. But she says, no, I'm parking the car. I'm coming in with you. And I went, oh, okay, so I think she's just gonna check me in. She does not. She stays by my side for the first 3 hours in that ER, making sure that I was okay, that someone was advocating for us while I needed to comfort Daisy, and someone was talking to the doctors while I was tending to her, tending to the baby while I signed papers or did whatever is needed in the chaos of the ER. And one thing I kept hearing over and over from friends and medical professionals was how calm I was. And truly, I was a mess inside. And I do not think I could have held myself together like that without someone advocating for us like that, without someone standing by my side, without all the friends that converged on our house to make sure that I didn't burn the house down with that lasagna that was still in the oven, who were taking care of our kids, making sure they were fed and put to bed. And I kept thinking about how there are so many others that are going through crisis right now, and how devastating and difficult it would be to do that without support. Specifically, I was thinking about a mother I know who gave birth at Christmas to a little baby girl shortly after her husband was deported. I kept thinking about what that must have been like for her to go into labor and to show up at the hospital, not having her husband holding her hand and telling her he was there for her. I kept wondering what it must have been like for her to arrive home from the hospital with that baby to find an empty house. to have an infant to care for and to worry, how am I going to provide for her? And what must it be like for that father who has never met his child? The heartache of knowing that she's probably learned to smile by now and she will not, he will not get to see that in person. What irks me when I tell this story is that I have people assume that the father must have done something terribly wrong. Or they shrug and ask, why doesn't the mom just go to Central America and join him if they really want to be together? Or worse, I am told that we are better off now. Our people have more jobs. Our resources won't be drained, and our children will be safer. And I want to know how we have gotten here, where we rationalize a broken family, or where we shrug off another person's suffering, where we make decisions based on fear and greed rather than love and generosity, where we've categorized people, human beings, as us and them, and if they are a them, then it is not our problem. Where we've determined that some people are worth more than other people, where we see people unable to flourish and find that acceptable. We're spending the 6 weeks of Lent talking about the same story each Sunday, the story of the Good Samaritan. And the story is told by Jesus to describe what it means to love your neighbor. And the story takes place on a road going from Jericho to Jerusalem, and it's a road that's about 18 miles long. So that's about the distance from Bend to Redmond. So that's quite a bit of distance to walk. And according to this historian, this road is pretty sparse. It's sort of rock and desert, and there's not a lot of travelers on it, but still enough that are traveling between the two cities that bandits would hide out behind the rocks and occasionally attack and rob whoever was coming down the road. And so Jesus tells a story of a man who falls prey to this exact scenario. And the thing to know when you listen to this story is that Samaritans and Jews despised each other. And all the characters in the story are Jews, except, of course, for the one Samaritan. So this is from Luke chapter 10. A man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho. He encountered thieves who stripped him naked, beat him up, and left him near death. Now it just so happened that a priest was also going down the same road. And when he saw the injured man, he crossed over to the other side of the road and went on his way. Likewise, a Levite came to that same spot, saw the injured man, and crossed over to the other side of the road and went on his way. A Samaritan, who was on a journey, came to where the man was, but when he saw him, he was moved with compassion. The Samaritan went to him, bandaged his wounds, tending to them with oil and wine. Then he placed the wounded man on his own donkey, took him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day, he took 2 full days' worth of wages and gave them to the innkeeper and said, "Take care of him, and when I return, I will pay you back for any additional costs." What stands out to me in this story is that this total stranger, a despised stranger no less, sees another total stranger who is suffering. And without hesitation, he gives up his donkey, his oil and wine, his travel plans, his time, his wages, to make sure that this person is cared for. After telling this story, Jesus says, this is how you should treat one another. Yet, here we are. My husband is always telling me to stop, just stop reading the comments after online articles, especially articles that have to do with immigration or gun violence or something as simple as bike lanes. But I just cannot help myself. I'm appalled at how people treat each other, how people get in these terrible arguments to prove how right they are, and how there is such blatant disregard for the humanity of another person. I'm reminded of Mother Teresa when she says, if we have no peace, it is because we have forgotten that we belong to each other. So this Lent, I love that we're reading through Mending the Divides, Creative Love in a Conflicted World. More so than ever, we need to be learning about how to better be in this world as people of peace and followers of Jesus, the Prince of Peace. We'll be focusing on the how in the coming weeks. But before we get there, we need to have an understanding of the what. What is peacemaking? One of the authors, John Huckins, he tells this story about how he went to his daughter's preschool. So his daughter's four, and he went to his daughter's preschool to talk to them about his work as a peacemaker. And they kept thinking he was saying he was a pizza maker. And it's not that. In both the Hebrew and Greek, so both in the Old and the New Testament, the alternative translation for peace is wholeness. Wholeness, it better captures what it means in what is meant in the scriptures when it says peace. It is the understanding that peace is not simply about eliminating conflict. It's so much more than that. Peace as God intends it is about moving into spaces, moving into situations where lives are not flourishing, and working to heal the brokenness that it is causing. I like this alternative so much, I like to replace the word peace with wholeness whenever I come across it. So the Prince of Peace is now the Prince of Wholeness. And when we talk about us being peacemakers, rather, we are wholeness makers. John Huckins writes that we should seek a faith that intentionally moves towards conflict, difference, and disagreement, equipped to heal rather than win. Because the purpose of peacemaking isn't to be right. It isn't to win. It isn't to make one's life more comfortable. It's to heal. It's to make lives whole, communities whole, the world whole, so that humanity flourishes. In the conversations taking place in our community and around this country about serious issues that impact the flourishing of lives like gun violence and immigration, I wonder what it would look like if we approached and engaged those conversations as wholeness makers, people seeking to heal rather than to win. In 1992, a woman was laying on her living room floor in Ann Arbor, Michigan, coming off of a high and desperate for her next hit. She'd been addicted to drugs for some time. And she says she would sometimes drive around town with her baby in the car seat, in the back seat, piled high with chocolates and candy to keep him quiet and entertained, while she would get high. But this particular night, her child slept in the bedroom while she lay on her living room floor, full of anxiety that she felt almost constantly. And she was at her breaking point and desperate for help. Her mom, who she hadn't had a relationship with in years, had somehow given her a card with a phone number to a Christian counselor on it. And her mom told her, if you ever need help, day or night, you call this number if you are unable to call me. And her daughter had held this card and bent it and folded it, and it was tattered, and where it was folded, it was just about tearing apart, but you could still see the phone number on it, and she had never dialed it. But that night, she dialed that number. And she hears a man pick up the phone, and he kind of muffles a hello, and she says, I'm really desperate for help, and I need someone to talk to. And she hears him kind of moving around and shuffling, and she hears things moving, and it sounds like he's getting out of bed. And he's like, okay, sure, I can talk. And she pours out all these things that are weighing heavy on her. All these things, these ugly truths about herself and her situation and her life that she had never voiced before, and she talks to him until the sun rises. And he listens without judgment. He listens with kindness and gentleness and compassion. And as the sun rises, she says, "You know, I feel so much better now. Thank you. And this has been so helpful." And she says, I thought Christian counselors were supposed to give you verses or something to read. And, you know, I'll read them. If you give them to me, I'll read them, I promise." And he says, "I don't know how to tell you this, but I'm not a Christian counselor. You dialed the wrong number." She had called this man at 2 a.m. in the morning, and he had talked to her, or he had listened to her all night. And after she hangs up, she doesn't get clean that day, but this man's compassion had held her together at her most broken. It opened up the possibility to her that healing is possible and to get help. She goes on to teach at a college. Her son, that baby boy, graduated from Princeton University in 2013, and she's currently earning her PhD. And she never, because this was 1992, she doesn't know what number she dialed. And she never talks to that man ever again. She doesn't know who he is to this day. Such peacemaking, such wholeness making, is a way of being. It's living a life of love. It's the understanding that there is no us and them in the kingdom that God envisions, but only a we. I used to watch Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood as a kid, and yes, it was shown in Micronesia. And I still remember how sincere and how kind and attentive he was to everyone. And one of the things he's known for saying is this quote: "When I was a boy, I would see scary things in the news. My mother would say to me, look for the helpers. You will always find people who are helping." So these days, I'm looking for the helpers, the people who take notice of what is broken in our world and move with love to heal and help. And this is to our youth, as well as their parents and their grandparents and loved ones. I am ashamed that we have allowed our broken world to come down to bear on you. I stand by you in whatever support you need. I commit myself to healing the gaps that we have neglected in our mental health services, in our schools, in our gun laws, and in our continuum of care. I am always telling people at how amazing our youth are. How kind, how generous, how conscientious this upcoming generation is. And I have so much hope for our future. I see upcoming leaders who are choosing love in unity over fear in division. And I will do whatever it takes so that our youth will continue to flourish into those people. I hope that each of us takes seriously our call to be peacemakers and wholeness makers in this conflicted world, and choose every day and in every encounter to live lives of healing love. Amen. We will continue our service with our offering. I want to point out these blue buckets in front of us. These blue buckets are something that we call sensibility. And it's for you to take all your spare change, any extra change that's not a part of the offering, to drop it into the, that's why when you heard that girl adorably pour all her coins in into the bucket, that's what it's for, to hear all this spare change so that we can change the world one meal at a time. And the money all goes towards hunger prevention around this country. Half stays locally and half goes, gets spread out around all the 50 states. Anyways.